And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, one day after Mother's Day, we are replaying an interesting morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. We are going to be talking about something that is about as universal as a topic can be, the topic of being born. And believe me, you don't have to be a parent yourself to find the topic fascinating and, of course, intensely personal. And I have learned so much reading a fascinating new book called Birthday. A pediatrician explores the science, the history, and the wonder of childbirth. This is something which, of course, ties all of us together. All of us, everyone that we know, and, of course, every human being on the planet has been born, albeit sometimes under very, very different circumstances. And through human history, the way in which birth has been handled logistically, medically, if you like, how it has been approached socially, has changed dramatically. And of course, when you combine differences through history, differences across cultures, you end up with just this amazing stew. And I am just astounded at how beautifully Dr. Mark Sloan sorts through all of that rich, complex history and shares it with us in this book. Dr. Mark Sloan has been a pediatrician for more than a quarter century, and he has written for the Chicago Tribune and San Francisco Chronicle, among others. And he writes this book not only from his perspective as a pediatrician, but also as the father of two teenage children. And so woven in with some of the case studies of his own medical career are also the stories of his own children being born. This book is published by Ballantine Books. Again, it's called Birthday. A pediatrician explores the science, the history, and the wonder of childbirth. And Dr. Mark Sloan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate being on the show.
One of the things that I think would be interesting to clarify is how you characterize your own medical practice, at least at the time of you writing this book, as being something of a dinosaur in terms of the kind of pediatrician that you are, or I guess maybe more specifically, the way in which you have been able to practice this particular facet of medical science. Can you explain to our listeners the way in which you are a dinosaur and glad to be one?
Yeah, I am happy to be one. By dinosaur, I meant the trend in the last few years, not just in pediatrics, but in pretty much all branches of medicine, is for people coming out of their training to make a decision. Are you going to be a hospital-based doctor, or are you going to be an outpatient clinic-based doctor? And more, there's not really much overlap with that. And I came up at a time when a pediatrician, you know, worked in the intensive care nursery, took care of very sick children, also had your outpatient practice, and I enjoyed it a lot because, you know, I would meet families oftentimes in times of great duress when they were having a sick baby, and then here I've carried that child through till high school graduation. And that part I enjoyed. It's getting less common to be able to do that, and that's what I meant by being a dinosaur.
And, of course, because you are that kind of dinosaur, it allows you to write this book from so many different perspectives. I'm intrigued by a term which you give us at the very end of the book in the afterword, a German word called Umwelt. Tell us what this word means, and in a sense what this concept has to do with your book, Birthday.
Well, I got that term reading Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez, who's a nature writer that I really enjoy. And he was using it as a biologist uses it to describe the worldview of a particular creature. You know, in his case, he was looking at polar bears and things like that. And he was talking about how different the worldview is for a bear rambling around looking for his food and for the seal who's trying not to be his food, but everything in the environment is part of that person's Umwelt. And it struck me that was what a baby's going through, what parents are going through, what we all go through. Our Umwelts change over time. You know, the idea of a child going from a fetus to a baby, you know, suddenly everything has changed. by the time that child's 2 years old and its baby brother or sister shows up, then its whole world has changed again. And then by the time that child grows up to have children of its own, the whole process, we tend to think of stages in children and child development, but actually it's a big continuum. But through that whole process, the worldview, the everything that goes into that child's mind and experience changes.
Your book opens with an amazing story in chapter one, which is called 20 Babies, An Unexpectedly Quick Introduction to Vaginal Birth. And we read this story with nothing less than sheer astonishment that you, as a young medical practitioner, would be thrust into such such an important position of responsibility with so little real-life experience behind you. Tell us about your encounter with a woman named Tanya and the level of your inexperience at that moment in time.
Well, I can describe my inexperience in a few words by saying that I'm an Irish Catholic product of the 1950s. Excuse me. And women were very good at hiding their pregnancies in those days. So all through elementary school, high school, even into college, I rarely had anything to do with either pregnant women or with babies. And so when I started my third year of medical school, this was my second rotation, the obstetrics rotation. And the night before, medical students weren't expected to do much. You were supposed to kind of be there to help hold things and to go fetch things. So I decided, I should read up about labor and delivery. And so I remember I read about half the chapter, and I didn't get it done. And I figured, I'll finish it the next night. What could happen? And the hospital I was working in at the time was because of a nationwide nursing shortage at the time, and this particular hospital didn't fill all its spots for their OB residents right off the bat, so there was this gap of time where they were very short-staffed. So what the resident did with us is he just took the medical students and had us sit by the bed of a woman in labor, and literally his instructions were, call me when you see a head, and then he would run back and do the deliveries. Well, Tanya I was sat at her side for about 2 hours, I think hour and a half, 2 hours, and nothing much happened. I talked to her, and we got along as well as you can in a situation like that. And then, but suddenly she had what's called a precipitous delivery, meaning when she got close to delivering, she went pretty fast. And it was one of those perfect moments when the nurses had gone off to do something and the doctors had gone off to do something, and then I was left there by myself as this baby's head was emerging. And I still remember thinking at the time I can't believe I didn't finish the chapter. And so I was sitting there with my hand on the baby's head, pushing back, hoping somebody would come and save me. And eventually they did. But, so that was my introduction to childbirth. it made a lasting impression.
I should think one of the things you say about this, because you came to this with only really medical experience from the VA, you wrote at one point, not only had I not seen a baby born at the VA, I had not seen a single female patient. The woman climbing onto the bed in front of us would be the first woman I had ever touched with medical intent. I suppose it's not all that common for somebody to be thrust into that situation in quite the same way that you were. At least we hope that not too many young doctors to be are given that kind of responsibility with so little behind them.
Well, I think it certainly has changed a lot. I help teach family practice residents in California, where I'm from, and their education is quite a bit more civilized than mine was. When I talk to doctors who've read the book, they all laugh because they all have experiences, whether it's an emergency room or a labor and delivery suite or whatever, if they're my age, that you just kind of got thrown into things and you were suddenly in way over your head. But I think medical education has improved quite a bit since then.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Sloan. We're talking about his book, Birthday. One of the first things which you explore is the whole matter of how human birth tends to be a rather painful ordeal, sometimes fraught with some risks. And it's particularly striking to compare it with the relatively painless and seemingly much simpler birth processes of other mammals and primates in particular. Sketch for us, for instance, a few of the basic characteristics of the typical gorilla birth and the most striking ways in which that differs quite a lot from the way you and I are born.
Well, gorillas, I mean, you can sum it up nicely in that a gorilla mother tends to be about 300 pounds with a pretty broad body, and her fetus only weighs 3 pounds. So the birth actually takes place in about 20 minutes. The mother probably, for reasons of not wanting to look vulnerable, but she shows no real sign that she's giving birth. She just ambles off and has her baby. And physically, the baby really barely even touches the pelvic bones on the way out. The birth canal is big enough that the baby just comes right down very quickly. They compare that with us. You know, it takes 20 minutes for a gorilla. It takes about 15 to 18 hours on average the first time for a human female having a baby. And the tight squeezes that we see, the reason it takes so long, it's all compromises we've had in human evolution with several developments that have come along the way. And the first really was, we always think, well, it's probably the big heads. Well, that actually was the second adaptation we had to make. The first was when our ancestors began upright walking. For a lot of reasons, the shoulder girdle got wider. So the first thing that the female pelvis had to adjust to was this widening, very gradually widening shoulder girdle, and that caused the pelvis to get wider. And then as we got smarter with our freed-up hands and learned to make tools, and the brain got bigger. And so then as the fetal head got bigger, the pelvis expanded in the front-to-back dimension. So now you get a wider and a deeper pelvis than you would if in chimps or in gorillas. And so that was that begat our tight squeeze, having the baby the way we do.
You say at one point, the path to painful childbirth was not so much a divine curse as it was a complex compromise between what we once were and what we've since become. And in a sense, it's that sort of uneasy compromise, as you put it, that makes the human birth possible, but also very tricky. You liken it in one way to an Olympic bobsled run. Why is that a apt metaphor?
Well, because of all the changes the pelvis has gone through, again, looking at gorilla birth, the gorilla baby starts out, if you envision, not that gorillas lay flat on their back to have their babies, but if you envision that orientation, a gorilla baby starts out facing its mother's back, facing the floor more or less, and finishes in that same position, doesn't change positions at all. It's just a straight shot coming out. Human babies actually do a turnaround. They start out roughly in that same position that a gorilla fetus does, but by the time, I did that backwards, the gorilla baby ends up face up, and the human baby ends up face down, facing the floor. And that's had a lot to do with why we ended up having more social births, because that's a difficult position for a mother to take care of her own baby if the baby's facing down and away from her, as opposed to the gorilla birth where the baby's facing up towards the mother so she can clear mucus from the throat or take the cord off the neck, things like that. So I hope I didn't confuse you with that one. But we come out flipped over from our primate ancestors and our primate relatives.
Hmm. One of the also interesting metaphors which you use to describe kind of the complexity of this, I think this in some ways refers to how large the human head is, relatively speaking, is this picture of a man building a boat who gets a little too ambitious. Describe this picture to our listeners.
Well, it's, as the human brain added all these great features, millions and hundreds of thousands of years ago, it kept getting bigger and bigger to the point that something had to give, literally, because eventually if the pelvis got any wider or any deeper, then women were going to get very awkward in trying to flee from predators. And so there had to be a compromise. You have to have your mother survive long enough to have you, obviously. And I've lost my train of thought.
We were describing the boat being built in the
Richmond. So the third major compromise that came of all this evolutionary change in the brain was that we started having our babies in earlier and earlier stages of development. So in other words, the reason that our babies are so helpless at birth is because a lot of the brain growth, a lot of the brain development that goes on, that used to go on prior to birth, now goes on after birth. And that's why a human baby has to be about a year of age to have the basic skill sets that a gorilla baby has at birth. And that's because we've put off a lot of that development and that brain growth till after the baby's already outside the mother. So,
One of the things I think that was most enlightening to me is this dramatic change which occurs once the baby has exited the mother's body, and some tremendously dramatic things have to occur in really those first 5 minutes outside of the womb. And you write about this sort of transformation, in a sense, from, I think at one point you say, from ex-fetus to baby, as one of the most amazing things about all of this. Explain a little bit about this crucial first 5 minutes of a baby's life.
Well, it helps to back up a bit to the few hours before birth and to look how a baby is functioning as a fetus still inside its mother. And at that point, the fetus is getting everything from its mother. Food, water, and oxygen all comes via the placenta and the umbilical cord over to the fetus. And then within a few minutes of being born, all that has to change. The fetus has special bypass blood vessels to bypass the lungs. There's not much point in sending blood to your lungs, as a fetus, because you're not breathing, or that's not how you're getting your oxygen. But as soon as the baby's born and the cord is clamped, obviously your lungs become a big deal, and you have to start sending blood to your lungs. So the baby literally switches over its blood flow through its heart, through its body. Those bypass channels that served it so well as a fetus have to close off. The baby has to empty its lungs of amniotic fluid, bring in oxygen, and then has to start the process of figuring out who are these creatures out here and who's going to feed me and how am I going to stay warm. It always amazes me still when I go to birth how we just take that for granted, that's just going to happen, that the baby's going to cry, and off we go to the rest of life. But it is amazing to me how often that works well, seeing how complicated a process it really is.
I'd like to read just a portion of this second chapter, if you don't mind, because I think you say this so well. You are talking about a new baby that's been born. You give her the name Amy Lincoln to the parents of Beth and Jack. I think all of these names, of course, are changed. So you write this. She's not quite the baby her parents were expecting. The Amy that Beth and Jack have carried in their mind's eye these past 9 months is pink and cuddly, smiling and content, with Cupid's bow lips and little Gerber baby curls sticking up from the top of her head. This Amy, the one newly placed on Beth's abdomen by the midwife, is, well, none of that. She's pale blue and slippery, covered in blood, amniotic fluid, and a little meconium, newborn poop. The place on her head where the curls should be is matted and lopsided, the scalp pushed to one side like a bad toupee. She's bandy-legged and pigeon-toed, squinty-eyed and squalling. Beth and Jack look over at me, not sure whether they should be alarmed. I smile and nod encouragement. Just wait. In the decades since Tanya's wild delivery and Mitch's parting advice, I've learned to do just that. And sure enough, in a few short minutes, everything changes. Amy calms down, her initial frantic cries soothed by Beth's touch and familiar voice. Her color shifts from blue to purple to pink. She opens her eyes and looks at the world, fixing first on Beth's face and then on Jack's. She squirms her way to Beth's waiting nipple, opens her mouth, and takes it in as though she's been doing all of this all her life. And just like that, aided by the kind of new parent vision that's blind to blood, goo, and odd-looking heads, Amy Lincoln becomes the cherubic pink fluff bundle of her parents' dream. You finish by saying Amy's transformation from battered-looking ex-fetus to the baby her parents were expecting is dramatic, but those of us present at a birth see only the external, cosmetic part of the story. The real action takes place inside Amy herself, hidden from view. It is nothing short of miraculous that the vast majority of babies make their way through this incredible transition without a hitch. Nearly 3,000 births into my career, those first few minutes of life are still the most amazing of them all. It's so striking because I kind of wonder how many, I mean, as someone who's who never has nor never will have children, I had absolutely no idea about any of this. But, I mean, does the typical parent or set of parents, do they know this going in, anything about these first 5 minutes of their new baby's life?
Well, it depends on a lot has to do with the kind of prenatal education they've had, whether that's from parents or their own parents, usually the mother, or relatives or friends who've been through it, or through formal prenatal education. But no, most, when I talk to parents about this, I teach them prenatal classes, they're very surprised to hear all the things that have to go on for the baby to come out, as healthy as we expect them. And it always helps like in those classes, I do warn them because it's a big shock to a lot of parents, just like it was in that vignette. A lot of times they're just scared to death.
And sure.
I tell them my rule of thumb is if none of the people in the room, the nurses, the doctors, are jumping up and down and looking worried, then don't worry about it. Whatever you're looking at is probably normal.
You say a fetus waiting to be born is so different from a newborn baby that it might as well be another species. One particularly intriguing thing you tell us helps us understand a little bit about the purpose, the hidden purpose of the contractions that a mother experiences. I mean, obviously, on the most basic sort of level, those contractions are to get the baby out. Mm-hmm. But you tell us that there is something else going on with those contractions, that bit by bit, contraction by contraction, the nearly born fetus is being transfused with its own blood. Explain a little further about how that happens.
A fetus, half of a fetus's blood volume is actually out of its body. It's in the placenta. And again, a lot of people misunderstand placentas. There's a maternal side and there's a fetal side. The blood doesn't really mix between the two of them. But about half the blood is actually sitting in the placenta at any one time. So the trick is that by the time that baby is born, you got to get that blood back into the fetus becoming a baby. And that's what the contractions do. Uterine contractions in labor, they're about the same as the blood pressure of a small adult. So it's exactly the pressure you need that with each contraction, a little bit more blood gets pushed from the placenta back into the fetus. And then the space in the uterus gets smaller as the baby is being pushed out, there's less room for the blood to come back into the placenta, so it just keeps pushing more into the baby. And then right at birth, if the obstetrician just leaves the baby in his or her lap for 30 seconds or so, more blood will flow from the placenta into the baby. So it is sort of like a transfusion with the baby's own blood. It's been out in the placenta all that time, and now it's getting pushed back in.
You pose a fascinating question, and the kind of question that very few people think to even ponder. And that is, what compels a newborn baby to take that first big breath and perhaps to start crying, which is, of course, what you want to have happen. My own mother vividly remembers in her woozy state when my youngest brother was born and did not immediately breathe and did not immediately cry. Remembers the worried dialogue between doctors and nurses and so on in the delivery room. He ended up needing to go into an isolette because things didn't work quite right. And you tell us an even more harrowing story of a young newborn that did not seem to understand that it needed to start breathing on its own, a young baby you call Sean. In his story, we learn a little bit about this critical moment in any newborn's existence when their lungs begin to operate in this different way. What is it that occasionally goes wrong here?
Well, in that case, Sean had a condition called persistent pulmonary hypertension, which is basically, I think the best way to think of it is that his circulation got stuck in fetal mode and didn't he couldn't kick himself out of it. And that happened because his mother had a complication that threw Sean into shock, still as a fetus. And at any age, you know, if we were to suddenly have blood loss or be very sick with an infection and we went into shock, the first thing your body's going to do is try to send blood to where the oxygen's coming from. So in our case, it would be to send it to the lungs and then on to the brain and the heart to keep you going. Well, in a baby, the instinct is to send it to the placenta. But in his case, his placenta was failing because of the complication the mother had, so this wasn't doing him any good. And at birth, that for a lot of reasons, that caused him not to do that transition, you know, that switch over of the blood flow through the heart. And so he was literally a baby who thought he was still a fetus. He was on the outside, you know, trying to send blood to a placenta that wasn't there anymore.
Hmm. You write at one point his heart and lungs were behaving as if he were still in the womb. And as you said, that transition, which typically goes smoothly, in his case, fell apart before it even began. And we can only imagine how frightening it would be for somebody to experience this kind of thing. What made this also frightening is that apparently this occurred in a relatively small facility or small hospital, mm-hmm. not really adequately equipped to deal with this kind of frightening turn of events.
Yeah, in our hospital, we're considered a level 2 out of 3 hospital, and that's a basic well-stocked community hospital. But when you have unusually sick babies, then you need to get them to a level 3 hospital, which is in his case, we had to transfer him down to a hospital in San Francisco. But we're capable of stabilizing a child, getting them to where you know they need more treatment than we can provide, but we can keep them in as good a shape as we can until the ambulance gets there.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Sloan about his book, Birthday. In the third chapter of the book, you explore the phenomenon of Caesarean birth mm-hmm. and trace for us the dramatic way in which this has changed so much over the course of 2 centuries, you say. Caesarean section has transformed from a grisly last rite into a surgery so successful that its arrival typically gives a sense of relief rather than horror. That is, when one is going to undertake a Caesarean birth, you have a sort of a feeling that all is almost even more certain to go well and in predictable fashion than if one is being going through a natural childbirth. Contrast that now, the sort of ordinary way with which we regard the Caesarean section, with the way it once was regarded. I mean, it was really for a whole different reason that Caesarean births occurred.
Mm-hmm. With Caesarean births, it's probably the most dramatic change in obstetric care since in the last couple of centuries. But really, it was an act of desperation before the 19th century. There was just an effort to try to get the mother was dying in childbirth, and the effort was to try to at least get a living baby out of this, a very bad situation. And it rarely worked. It was done as an act of desperation, as I said. Now that all started to change in the 19th century, and there's a series of medical innovations that helped. The first was when adequate pain relief came around because of ether and chloroform, and that helped give doctors time to do what they needed to do to get the baby out, and also made them a little more inclined to do the surgery earlier before the mother was completely at death's door. And since that time, the next big jump was when antibiotics came in the 1930s that again made it safer to do the surgery, which got doctors to want to do it a little bit earlier before the mother was in real bad shape. And then through to today, where about a third of babies are born by C-section now, which has put us in this ironic position of something that started out as such a godsend. We have to start to decide, how many babies do we really want to be born by C-section? Does everybody have to be a C-section? And it's made for a pretty lively controversy in obstetrics in the last couple decades.
Right. And I love how you characterize it at one point as saying that Caesarean birth has become so commonplace it could even be planned ahead of time, almost like a family vacation. And indeed, of course, although not all, the vast majority of Caesarean births are planned ahead of time. One of your children was born by Caesarean. And you tell us kind of an interesting story about an exchange which you had with, I think, a special family friend or somebody, an older person. Yeah, and the way in which they reacted to this. Just share that with our listeners, if you would.
Yeah, Sister Carola was a nun who lived in St. Louis, and it was a good friend of our family's and had been a special friend of mine since I was a little kid. My aunt was in the convent down there, and we used to visit, and she was always the one who slipped me the brownies, so she was my buddy. But when my wife, she had a planned C-section because of a complication, so it was something we knew had to happen anyway. It wasn't a surprise at all. And Sister Carola, we had had some difficulty having our first baby, and so she had launched her prayer campaign that had gone on, I think, for several years to try to get us through all this stuff. And but I called her right after my son John was born to let her know that the C-section was over and that he was fine and she was fine. And to me, this was fairly routine stuff. I wasn't expecting any problems. And she got very teary, and she said, "Oh, thank God. I was so worried when I heard, you know, your wife was going to have that operation." And the way she said that operation, it sounded like, you know, it made me realize in retrospect after she died a few years later when I was researching the book that she had started, and she had been a nurse when she joined the convent, in the 19-teens when this was still a very dangerous surgery. And she undoubtedly knew a lot of women who didn't get through the surgery or babies who didn't get through the surgery. So to her, that formed her opinion of the cesarean that many decades later. So her life pretty much spanned the end of the desperation era and the beginning of the almost routine nature of C-section.
The second section of the book deals with the pain that is almost always associated with childbirth, unless you have the intervention of something like an epidural. At one point you write this: "Childbirth is perhaps the only human condition in which pain is considered by many to be an unqualified good. It's also the only one in which the decision to reduce or eliminate pain is the subject of sometimes ferocious debate." It's probably a little hard for those of us who haven't been in the trenches of this particular issue to fully understand that. But sketch for us sort of the heart of the disagreement over this matter of pain and whether or not pain can be and should be removed from the experience of childbirth.
Well, when I started researching the section on pain, labor pain, I thought I was just going to be writing a small chunk about epidurals, and that was going to be in a larger chapter about other things. But as I started researching it, I saw there are tremendous differences in how labor pain is managed, even in Canada versus the U.S., and certainly in Europe versus the U.S. You know, in the U.S., when you count in the number of C-sections, virtually all of which are done with epidurals, about 80 to 90% of women in many areas give birth with epidurals, and they're very effective. I mean, they wipe pain out pretty well. But when I was looking for epidural rates and statistics in Europe, I kept seeing other things pop up, and in particular, in England, I saw a lot of statistics for the use of nitrous oxide, or what we call laughing gas, and that as many as 70% of women there, if they're laboring normally, will use nitrous oxide at some point during their labor. And I thought, that's interesting. I'll go back and look at the U.S. statistics. And I found in the U.S. there's only two hospitals that even use it anymore. And so there's this big gap, and it really is a major difference in emphasis between the U.S. and other countries. Britain, they have the term good enough pain relief. But they feel that the pain of labor, and it's a natural part of the process. And so they use nitrous oxide just to take the edge off the pain enough for the mother to get through her contractions at the most painful part of things. And here, you know, especially when I was starting out in the 70s in medical school, the idea was to obliterate the pain, you know, make the woman have as little pain as possible. Let's just, you know, that's sort of archaic to be putting up with that kind of pain. And as I said in the book, in virtually every other aspect of medicine, pain's a bad thing. And so you're sent out as a new doctor with the idea that you really need to reduce or eliminate pain as much as possible. So it was always difficult for me at first to understand women who turned down an epidural, who you know, would rather do the natural childbirth or would you know, depend on herbal remedies, things like that. But as I researched the book, you realize there's I think it was Isaac Newton who said that nature does nothing without reason. And there are reasons for what we go through in labor. There's a lot of things going on that we don't see in terms of, finishing up the development of the immune system in babies and things like that that's related to labor. So that's been a shift for me through the course of the book, because I came into it thinking, well, epidurals are great, gets rid of your pain, to rethinking that and thinking that here in the U.S. we should be supporting women if they want to do an alternate choice like nitrous oxide to just help them get through it.
You say at one point that one of the things that was said on the side of from physicians who were suspicious of anything that would vastly cut or even entirely eliminate pain from the childbirth process is that many physicians considered pain to be a useful guide to the progress of a woman's labor. It sounds like what you're saying is doctors would use a woman's pain to help know if things were going the way they're supposed to go or how far along a delivery was going, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. That was from the section on the 19th century history of labor pain management. And there was I love the 19th century. It's a gold mine for any kind of historical things you want to dig up, because they wrote everything down. And there were huge fights when James Simpson, who was an obstetrician in Scotland, introduced chloroform for normally laboring women as a pain reliever in the 1840s and 1850s. And he was met with fierce resistance from the establishment. The established medical community. They rightfully wondered about the effects of this untried medicine on fetuses. It did end up being very dangerous in some cases. There was the biblical injunction of, God telling Eve, you will have your babies in pain, which didn't last very long when theologists really looked at that as an objection. And it was a huge fight. One of the doctors from the United States, one of the leading obstetricians, said that, that they, in those days before monitoring and things, that's how he gauged how far along the woman was in her labor, when she was getting in trouble or how, but James Simpson just thought that was a bunch of hogwash and told him so in all kinds of letters and journal articles. So it was a huge fight, but that's where that came from.
Interesting. One of the matters which this brings up, and it segues us nicely into what will probably be our last topic we can talk about today, is kind of the question of who is involved in childbirth. And you tell us in this chapter, focused on pain, the relief of pain, that in many respects, the question of relieving pain, for instance, as it was confronted by Dr. James Simpson, who was the doctor for Queen Victoria and who utilized chloroform for her last couple deliveries, that for Dr. Simpson and others since, the overarching question is the same one that drove the painless childbirth controversy of a century and a half ago. Who should control what goes on in the labor room, the doctor or the woman giving birth? A lot rides on that question. Just tell us a little bit about the way in which that central question has played out over history and in different cultures.
Well, that really has come full circle, because up until the 19th century, birth was a matter between a woman, her female family members, and a midwife, and men were not very much involved in it. And then from the 19th century through most of the 20th century, it was much more of a male-dominated, we're going to call the shots here type of arrangement. And it's come full circle, especially since the 1990s, when a lot of studies showed that a woman who feels that she has her needs attended to, that she feels she's involved in the decision-making process and in what goes on in the birthing room, actually she will have a better outcome. She's less likely to have a C-section. She's less likely to need a lot of pain medications. There's an element of control, not in the sense of a control battle, but that she feels that she's in control of her body and her in this birthing process, and that her sensations, her feelings of what's going on in the birthing room are respected, because she's the one having the baby. So, and as someone obviously who's never had a baby myself, it's very difficult to understand why we wouldn't go that route, why we wouldn't want more and more to have the mother be the one who's actually in control, so to speak, of what's going on there.
I guess what some people might argue is she wouldn't necessarily, and we wouldn't necessarily want her to be in charge of of her own open heart surgery or other incredibly complicated medical procedures. But there is something, I mean, this feels like something different that should be approached in a different way from that.
Well, this is a natural process. You know, having babies is a part of life. Having open heart surgery is something that you do when something goes wrong. And I'm not advocating that, you know, mothers should be able to just tell the doctors what they want. But there is a lot of leeway, particularly in pain management, where we've just kind of jumped to this, Judith Rooks, who's a wonderful midwife up in Portland, she describes as the epidural monoculture we've gotten ourselves into in this country. And even though you can show really good outcomes for a mother who's allowed to kind of follow her own instincts pain-wise, it is a big controversy. So no, I'm not advocating that women should be able to just dictate everything that's going to go on there. But on the other hand, I think listening to them more than we do would be a big help.
One of my favorite chapters, maybe my single favorite chapter in your book, is the seventh chapter, which is called The Gang's All Here, A History of Birth Attendants. This topic has intrigued me for a long, long time, partly in that my sister, when she had the second of her children, I believe, had about 10 people in the room. I wasn't one of them, but and there's a videotape of it, and you can kind of hear all these different voices of all these different people sort of acting as cheerleaders for what was a relatively long and not particularly easy birth. But it just is striking to me to think about the choices that some people make about who is going to be with them. And of course, once upon a time, it wasn't a choice that the woman was given to make at all about who would be there. Again, just sketch, if you would, the amazing array of possibilities that have been seen through history in terms of who is present at the birth.
Well, we're the only, if you go way back, we're the only primate species that has birth attendants. You know, gorillas, chimps, everybody else, they just have those females have their births by themselves. And even if the female gets in trouble, there's not like a gorilla obstetrician going to come and get her out of trouble. So when our births got more complicated, the term that's used by anthropologists is obligate midwifery began, meaning you had to have somebody help you deliver your baby, or at least be there to help you or protect you from predators, or else that's such a vulnerable period of time for a woman that the death rates would have been, you know, astronomical and we wouldn't have gotten very far as a species. Once in recorded history, all the way back to ancient Greece, the support group that a woman had with her during birth tended to be female relatives, usually the experienced ones, those who'd had births themselves. They knew what was going on, and then some variation on a midwife to help do the deliveries. And that's really the way it went, and still is that way in a large part of the world. But in the United States, that's the way it was until the mid the late 19th century, when hospitalized birth took over. And then we went through this long period where no one was allowed in with the mother. My mom, she had seven of us between 1948 and 1961, and she doesn't remember anything about it. She was brought into the hospital, knocked out. We were all pulled out with forceps, and that was the end of that. My dad was down in the waiting room, or a couple times he just went home and took care of the older ones that were still hanging around there. And then it was the 1950s and 60s we started to see the liberalization of policies of having somebody in the room with you, because studies were starting to come out showing that, look, this is a ticket to problems if a woman doesn't have a support person with her. And then initially that was the father, and then in the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's more and more really kind of coming back to where it was, a lot of female relatives, female friends coming to births, and now we've gotten to the point where it's sometimes funny, the politics that go on in labor rooms, because oftentimes it's clear that the mother really didn't want her mother-in-law there, but she didn't know how to say no, or there's a lot of politics that wasn't there in the old days with it. So it's another one of these things that's kind of come full circle as people are realizing there was a reason that things developed they did. It makes for healthier birds.
You also make mention of the fact that for the typical father nowadays, they, generally speaking, feel an absolute obligation to be there. I mean, for a father to choose not to be in the delivery room is to risk being really looked at as less than a loving father or less than a loving husband. And there might be some very legitimate reasons why a father indeed might feel like their presence there is not particularly necessary or particularly helpful.
Yeah, you don't want to be labeled a bad dad. That's the worst thing. But this was, you know, when my children were born in 1990 and 1991, that was the heyday of the father as the labor coach, as the everything for his wife or his partner in the delivery room. So I took the classes. I learned how to help her breathe and things like that. Since that time, they discovered that oftentimes the father really isn't the best guy to be the coach because he's got his own issues. I mean, usually this is the most distressed he's seen his wife or partner in terms of pain, in terms of, a process that we as men really can't understand. You know, we're not having the babies. And so he has his own fears going through. A lot of researchers have showed that fathers, and I knew this myself, were worrying about, what would happen if she died or my baby died or something bad happened to them. And then meanwhile, I'm supposed to be coaching her to be doing the breathing. So it's come around again to where fathers, I think it's a great thing for a father to be present for the birth of his child if he wants to be there. And in some cases, if the mother wants him to be there, because sometimes it's agreed upon it and he's probably better off outside. But the ideal situation, I think, is to allow that particular couple to figure out if they want him to be the coach or not, and to provide usually again an experienced female companion for the woman to have with her, somebody who's gone through this before and understands it, and let the dad do his fetching the ice chips and just mopping her brow and just be a comfort person, not really not really be the coach. Although a lot of dads do make great coaches, I think that should be something that's a choice, not really. An assumption that that's going to happen.
As you trace the history of this, you mentioned that in some cases studies on the importance of the father being there proved to be extremely biased studies, mm-hmm. or other cases in which a study might be, in your words, long on speculation and short on science. And of mm-hmm. course, this long, fascinating history of childbirth is fraught with that. And mm-hmm. And in many respects, for as personal and human as this book is, it's also a story about what real science is and how crucial it is that we have a scientific understanding of this amazing, miraculous process. The book is Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth, published by Ballantine Books, the author, Dr. Mark Sloan. Dr. Sloan, I thoroughly enjoyed your book and learned so much from it. And I thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.